fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Don't welcome cry, back on Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
You wing. Call us toll free 1-888-429-5471.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Said don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories.
Oni Vatanen with us. She is the author of On the Wings of a White Horse, A Cambodian Princess Story of Surviving Genocide. She was born in Cambodia and a member of the royal family. Her father was a member of the royal family. And her father and her mother and almost 3 million Cambodians on the educated class were murdered. And it was genocide of a horrific scale and a disastrous effect. And all intellectuals were slaughtered, all of them, and eliminated an entire generation of educated leadership. In the tragedy and in the lasting impact in her book, On the Wings of a White Horse, she wrote the book to tell the story of those who didn't survive. And let's say, Ani, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I'm very honored. And I love the music.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'm so glad you're here. By the way, you know, we're running into a world today where we're starting to see more and more people worldwide dying, and there's genocide happening, and you just in country after country after country, and it wasn't this bad until recently. It's always been there, but what is it that you see today that could, if you go back to Cambodia in your mind, that was like Cambodia? Where do you see the similarity in the world today?
You know, I see is, like myself, I was suffering because the world's leader was not strong enough to enforce the rule of law, especially corruption and murder everywhere, because the greed is making people in a blind eye, especially United Nations, that the rest of the world, that turned the blind eyes in innocent people and jested a human rights everywhere.
And now, by the way, are you talking money? When I say you're talking money, is this what creates it? Is this what's behind it? When it comes down to it, money.
Yeah, I think it's come down with the greed and money, and then people just do anything to murder people because of the money.
Now, by the way, let's go back for a while when we said the genocide. You're talking a lot of people. It just wasn't, you know, a few hundred. You're talking about millions of people who die. How can the world let things like this pass? And I know we're talking about greed and money and people turning a blind eye to it. There's no question. But in the world that we live in, you know, yesterday and today, when you have this kind of killing going on, what do you think stops the world from standing up and taking a stand to this? Because if it can happen in Cambodia, it can happen right here in the United States.
Well, like, for example, people are afraid to stand up the truth and tell the truth. If you would stand up and speak the truth and speaking from the heart, from your ideas, and the chances, you're not going to be survived, and you have two chances to assassinate it or lock up in prison. There's no democracies in this world right now.
Now, by the way, what was it like as a youngster living there? My goodness, as a young girl, you didn't know anything. Young people really don't know anything. They know based on, you know, what their peer group is like, what they learn in school, but just the possibility of dying. What was it like?
It was horrific tragedies in my life. It was without any basic of food, without any basic of blanket or cold, you know, like just the basic like waters or classroom. We didn't have in that ancestry with us. And I think live in Cambodia, I see so much pain and suffering in my childhood.
And by the way, you were moving from concentration camp to concentration camp. It almost sounds like Germany during the Second World War.
Yes, it sounds like it, Germany. Yes.
Now, by the way, is there anything that could have been done? You know, in today's world, there are survivors, obviously, but that base core culture from Cambodia was killed. They were annihilated, and they just didn't have the chance to become who they were. If this hadn't have happened, what do you think the world there would have been like. The people that were murdered that could have been responsible to adding to the culture, to the education, to the legacy of Cambodia. How different do you think the country would be?
I think if the UN would take the bold step to change the rule of law and to stand up for the rights and wrong, I think it's much better. But the world today, if people have so much money, if people have so much money, it is the little ones cannot do anything to prevent the genocide or even freely exercise a freedom of speech. We didn't have that basic skill.
Now, Ani, I don't want to lead you anywhere, so I'm gonna create the question and then just give me your answer. So this isn't a lead, all right? What I've seen in this country so far, the United States of America, there's not a country in this world that can stand up militarily to us. So if you want to destroy this country, what you do is you start dividing. You divide gender, you divide religion, you divide ethnicity, and it goes on and on. And then if you do that, there's a weakness, and that weakness causes the core culture.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Call us toll free anytime during the show. That's 1-888-429-5471.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love.
Dr. Robert Cochran with us, the author of The Opiate Cure. Bob's received his medical training at Vanderbilt, Duke, and the University of Texas. He entered private practice in 1963, specializing in the field of internal medicine and neurology. And his mid-career, I can say it, it's the first show, he began his studies of chronic pain. Bob, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
And do you have anything for chronic voice failure?
That could be a real problem.
I hear you.
Like
by the way, what you know, we talk about traditional medicine, conventional medicine, cures for this, cures for that. But I would venture to guess that the majority of the American population, and extend that to wherever we can think of, chronic pain. It seems as though you watch people walking down the street, they're getting up and they're aching, they're sitting down, they're aching. They don't go out and exercise because it hurts. Do you find that a lot in your practice?
Oh, that's the entirety of my practice. These are very sick people.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when you say sick, are they sick or is it something that they're lacking in their overall health, in their overall health issues and or what they do every day to take care of themselves?
No, I think this is a disease. This is an illness. I believe now we can identify cause. We can understand the nature of the disease. We couldn't do that 20 years ago, but I think we can now. When I say sick people, these are people who have great difficulty functioning with the activities of daily living. This is they can't vacuum, they can't grocery shop, and most of them can't earn a living.
Okay, so we're really dealing with pain as a chronic pain, as an actual disease, not something that's just coming and going and you don't have the right I won't say medication, but the painkiller for it, the aspirin, the Excedrin, so on and so forth. It goes deeper than that.
That's a very good question. Chronic pain is a disease. Now, when I say chronic pain, this is pain that persists, pain that's associated with insomnia, it's associated with fatigue, it's associated with mental impairment, difficulty with concentration, distraction. It's a huge disease. Now, we identify it. I think erroneously, as many different diseases like fibromyalgia, chronic muscular pain, neuritis, pain in the extremities, nerve damage, migraine, irritable bowels. All kind of different names, but they have great similarity. The behaviors they induce are quite alike.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. Let's say if I was suffering from one of these diseases, and I would go to a doctor and I would say, you know, I've got this, and that symptom. Bob, what I'm really hearing is that the average practitioner may not recognize the symptom of what it truly is. They may not go underneath what it looks like to get to the real cause. Am I hearing this right?
You know, I'm not into conspiracy, but I think you're exactly right. I mean, most of our doctors are very, very good. They're also
sure.
very, very tired, and they're very, very rushed. I don't think many of them go to the heart of the issue, and that's what I'm trying to address with my writings.
And by the way, that's not nothing to do with conspiracy. That's just it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know that gets people into trouble. It's just like the diagnosis of ADD. Well, maybe it's really not ADD, and you're working on something that the kid doesn't have, and the kid, it just never goes away.
Well, you're pretty close there. ADD, attention deficit disorder, is ADD, but it has many parameters. It's linked to bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and on and on and on. These things are not freestanding entities. You know, it's not a case of a person having, say, attention deficit disorder, and that's it. We treat the attention deficit disorder. It's much broader than that. That's what I've learned. This is a broad, expansive disease with many faces.
Okay, so the first step is to truly understand what chronic pain is, understand what the symptoms are, and then let's talk about, quote-unquote, the cure, if there's ever really such a thing. So when we get into the opiates, we're talking about the morphines, codeines, and those kind of medicines. Are those the cure for what we're talking about? Are those the things to use to get to the heart of whatever this problem is?
Improbable and astonishing, as it may seem, they probably are.
Okay.
If I could explain myself a little bit.
Please.
I treat many people with chronic pain, and I get referrals from everybody from psychiatrists to urologists. They all have chronic pain. They all, or at least the great majority of them, have some coexistent psychiatric illness. Well, maybe all of us have some coexistent psychiatric illness. But I find that illness closely linked to the pain. So I have discovered that when I treat the pain with opiates, which I'm entitled to do, which I'm ethically bound to do,
sure.
I can often cure the associated mental illness. Now, that may be bipolar disease, attention deficit disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder. The list goes on. So my book is about the opiate cure. That is the cure of mental illness by the administration of opiates. And opiates will include oxycodone, hydrocodone, methadone, morphine, oxymorphone, hydromorphone. That's dilaudid and ropanol. There are probably about a dozen of them.
Yeah. Okay, but all right, so let me make sure we've got this straight. I'm not a clinician. I'm just going to paraphrase this. That someone can have chronic pain. That chronic pain can cause many neurological problems, many diseases, many things that people are getting treated for, and they seem to be able to manage them, but they never get over it. But if we treat the chronic pain, that byproduct, which would be the mental illness, the OCD, et cetera, it would in and of itself be taken care of because it is an offset or an offshoot of that chronic pain. If you don't have the chronic pain, you got the chronic pain cleaned up, the rest of the mental illness and those things that you mentioned will automatically disappear because the reason for them to be there has been diminished.
You're close, but I'm not sure that chronic pain causes mental illness. We are chronically painful as we are mentally ill.
Okay, so how do we tie the two together?
They're one and the same. They coexist. They're comorbid. It's all one big disease. In fact, I view pain as a major symptom of psychiatric illness.
Okay, all right. So then I've got it reversed then.
Yeah, let me take it a little bit further. I think some people, by virtue of their mental illness, and let's use bipolar disease, manic depressive illness, are destined to have pain. It is part of their disease. And when we treat that part of their disease, we can often cure the mood shifts, the inattention, and everything. That's what I write about.
Okay, so all right. So in essence, it's not the illnesses are not an offshoot of pain. It's the illnesses that use pain. Okay, it's the illnesses that hide underneath the pain, but in the end result, it's the illnesses that you have to go after, and
you're
you
doing
do
very
that.
Well. You're close to dead on.
Okay, and it's the opiates that really do the job. Now, are the opiates addictive?
Opiates are addictive, but that has always been a complicated issue, and as I've become something of an expert in it, it's even more complex. There are a lot of people out there, and I get emails about, and patients who tell me this all the time, who buy the opiates on the black market because they're the only drug that controls the mental illness. They buy the opiates because the doctor will not give them the right drug in the correct dosage to control the mental illness or the pain. And this is very much a theme of my books.
Okay, now, by the way, what does the AMA have to do this with this, the American Medical Association? Do they have any rules, any guidelines that will cause the doctors not to use them? Or are those doctors frightened if they use them, they're going to get sued? I mean, let's go back to...
The doctors are scared to death, not of being sued, but of losing their license.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you're 40 years old and you've got three kids you've got to raise, you don't want to lose your license.
No.
So this is not the AMA. This is the State Board of Health, of medical examiners, whatever, you know, we've got many different entities in this union, and they all have their own rules. But there is enormous pressure to not prescribe opiates.
Okay, this is kind of a reversible cause and effect here, because let's say that I have the problem. The doctor prescribes the opiates. I take the opiates. I like the opiates. And then something happens, and I blame the doctor for giving me too many opiates. So in essence, you've got the people who really need the opiates for the cure that are getting the doctors to walk on edge, because we go back and look at the Michael Jacksons, and I mean, this list goes on and on. And so in essence, the doctors are afraid to use it because they'll get sued if somebody decides they don't like the way that it was used.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of an interesting place to be.
Most of these celebrity deaths from opiates, they are many from prescribed physicians, and the physicians can be in here. I'm talking about Elvis and Whitney and Michael, but that is not the mainstream issue. Those drugs were being abused. There's no doubt about it. All those people were taking too much medicine.
Yeah.
Now, whether that was their fault or the doctor's fault, I don't know.
Yeah, but I personally know a doctor right now that was prescribing pain medication to a particular woman. The woman got upset with him, and she, you know, there was a lawsuit, and he lost his license. So the doctors have to be very careful today. We complain about all of these major costs, the high cost, etc. Well, of course there's high costs when you get into malpractice and all of the cost to run an office, and what that doctor has to, that fine line the doctor has to walk. It's kind of an interesting place to be, because from what I understand, and stop me if I'm wrong here, we're getting 40% less youngsters going into medical school today because of all these problems.
You're probably correct. Medicine's not near as attractive as it was 50 years ago when I went into it. You know, that was the cream of the cream. You know, you wanted to be a doctor.
I hear you. And everybody who had a daughter wanted them to marry you.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my son, the doctor.
Got it. Okay, hey, Bob, we're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's www.understandingpain.com.
Okay, understandingpain.com. Bob Cochran, thank you so much for joining us. I really like the way that we're looking at this, because it's a completely different look, and I think this message has to go out.
It is a different look, and thank you very much. And I'll tell you what, we need different looks. This is a societal issue of the first order, and we're not managing it very well.
No question. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here, Bob, and I love what you have to say. Good night.
Okay, thank you for inviting me.
When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me?
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Diane McCachran with us. She is the author of Big Green Purse, Use Your Spending Power to Create a Cleaner and a Greener World. She's a best-selling environmental writer, a sought-after public speaker, and founder of the www.biggreenpurse.com, which has received major media attention since its launch in early 2007. She's advised the Environmental Protection Agency, World Bank, World Wildlife Fund, and many other agencies and nonprofit organizations focused on protecting the planet. She's the author of the best-selling Save Our Planet, 750 Everyday Ways You Can Help Clean Up the Earth. And she's with us tonight. And say, Diane, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. I've got the actual magic on how to save money on gas prices when they don't matter. You ready for this one?
Yes.
Don't drive your car.
Very true.
Other than that, I've seen it go constantly up. I remember when, we won't tell anybody this is our secret here. But I remember when gas was only 18 cents a gallon. Now we've seen it rise. What do you think, in your estimation, based on your research and who you are and doing what you do, what is the cause of this high price in gas today?
Well, crude oil is just getting more and more expensive. You know, in 2010, crude oil was just about $80 a barrel, and today it's $35. It's $25 higher than that, about $105, $106 a barrel. So the cost of gasoline is directly related to the cost of crude oil. Gasoline in 2010 was on average about $2.78 a gallon. Today it's $3.79. It's just that, you know, when there's uncertainty in the Middle East, when there are problems like we're having right now with refineries in Texas are getting old. That's where a lot of our oil is converted into gasoline. That means that less gas is being produced, which pushes the price up. And then demand for gasoline is up all over the country. And so if you remember those basic economics lessons about supply and demand, you know, when supply shrinks and demand increases, the price increases too. So, you know, nobody should be surprised about this. We've seen this coming since the first oil embargo in 1973. And even if you weren't around then, it's in the history books. And we just keep digging this deep hole, depending on gasoline and depending on oil. And the only bright picture, really, I think, is that there's so much work being done to develop alternatively fueled vehicles.
Sure. Now, a couple of things we have to look at. You take, you know, the crude oil, you know, at the well. I'm going to pick a number. I don't know what the exact price is at the well. Maybe it's $12 or $13 a gallon. Okay. So a barrel, $12 or $13, whatever the case may be. Then you've got to ship it to the refinery. The cost of shipping is incorporated into it. Then it's refined. Then it's shipped to the gas stations. And all of these costs are incorporated in, plus taxes and so on and so forth. And then let's take another factor that we can throw into the mix. The traders, you know, they're trading ahead. They're banking on what it's going to cost, you know, 6 months, a year ahead of time. And so by the time we end up at the pump, it's gone through all of these processes, plus politically, whatever happens in that case, you were talking about that, politically, and the relationship between country to country and so on and so forth. By the time we look at it, then we've got our $5, $6, $7 a gallon gas. And it's not just as simple as it used to be.
Well, you're exactly right. And, you know, part of the problem, too, is we actually get most of our oil from North America. We get a lot of oil from Canada. We get a lot of oil from Mexico. But oil is traded on a global market. It's a world market. And so volatility in any one place upsets the price of oil and gasoline all over the world. And, you know, it's not just the Middle East there. We get oil from Nigeria. And there's a lot of unrest in Nigeria. Anytime there's a little blip anywhere along the production pipeline, it sends the traders, you're exactly right, into a tizzy. The price goes up. And all of us consumers are sitting here saying, wait a minute, it was only $3.20 yesterday, and why is it $3.75 today? And what am I going to do about that? You know, I have to fill up my tank. So, sure. what you said earlier about don't drive your car, I mean, to the degree that we can cut back on driving, carpool, combined trips, telecommute to work, shop online, all those things, it will really help us save money on gasoline. But, you know, you also have to think about whether or not that's a short-term solution. Really, sure. Long-term, we've got to think about the fact that this country and world overall is just remains way too dependent on petroleum. And until we transition to a safer, cleaner fuel, we're going to have this problem in the marketplace. You know, and even if you decide you're going to cut back, what about the manufacturer who's shipping a product to you?
Sure.
He's still going to have a high price, and that's going to be reflected in the cost of your product.
Oh, no question about it. You run into a couple of other things, too. You've got Alaska that's totally untapped up there. Well, not totally, but untapped. There's plenty of places to drill. You got Texas where there's plenty of places to drill. You got Mexico. You got Canada. You've got places right here in the United States up towards the Canadian border, three or four of the states, totally untapped. It's a little bit of a problem with the kind of oil it is, but it's clean upable. Now, you've got all of that, and you've got the pipeline that's going to go. Who knows where the Canadian pipeline is going to go? But here's the main problem. What you're saying is spot on, because if we tapped into everything and if we increased the amount that we reserved and we knew it was okay, and then the demand was the supply was greater than the demand, which would cause the price to go down, one variable that comes into play. It's a non-renewable source. Someday,
right,
we're going to run out of oil.
Right. And some people think that we've already hit the peak amount of oil that was available to us. And even with new technologies that are capable of tapping new sources of oil, that we're on the other end of the curve, that we have just really started to tap out our oil reserves. I will have to say that I disagree with you about tapping into untapped places in places like Alaska, for example. I've really looked at this extensively. And, you know, for example, there's an effort underway to try and open up the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. And there's only 5% of that wilderness area that's not being tapped up there. And the companies want to go in there and tap it. And the thing that kills me about that is that it takes about 10 years from the time you sink that well to the time you get gasoline at the pump. It's a 10-year process. It takes a really long time. If everybody started pumping up their tires today, proper pounds per square inch, you can find out what it is on the inside of the door jamb of your car, we would start getting today the amount of oil they think might or might not be there, but if it is there, the amount of oil that we'd be drilling that refuge for, it wouldn't be available for to us for 10 years. So we haven't even tapped really the greatest source of energy that's available to us, which is energy efficiency.
Now, by the way, maybe I didn't say it in the way that I would have loved you to hear it. What I was saying, the potential is there to get all of that oil, but it's non-renewable. And because it's non-renewable, we better be listening to what you have to say, because if it's not today, there's going to come a time when no matter where you tap into, there's not going to be any oil in the ground.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the other thing is that even if we decided we're just going to go for it and we're going to tap all the oil that's available and we're going to go ahead and burn all that oil, environmentally and from a human health point of view, we really can't afford to do that anymore. We can't afford to burn all that oil and put all that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We've got a climate change problem. When you burn any kind of carbon, you generate pollutants that increase asthma and cause smog, and they cause all kinds of respiratory problems. So we really can't afford to burn all that, even if we could get our hands on it.
And by the way, I'm with you, and I'm going to go back to my point. If we did get our hands on it, someday it's going to be gone. So if we don't start looking at alternatives, even if we're not going to look at the health issue, I understand smog. I was brought up in Los Angeles. I used to love it when I get on a plane. Haven't been there in years, but I'd fly in, I'd get out in L.A. airport, and the minute that I'd get off the plane, my eyes would slam shut, smog. So I was brought up in it. I truly understand it. The only problem that I have with your brand new book, and there's just one, I just can't walk down the street with a green purse. It's not going to work.
I should have called it the big green purse or pocketbook, because really the message is that, we consumers in many ways, even though we go out and buy stuff, we're very passive in terms of understanding how much power we have, whether we spend a dime or a dollar. Right now in Congress, I live right outside Washington, D.C., we cannot pass a piece of legislation to protect human health or the environment if we try. It's not going to happen. Total gridlock. And yet, we can create great change based on how we spend our money. And, women do spend most of the money at the marketplace, and so the focus is really on the purse. But for any of us who are shopping, the way we spend our money makes a real difference. I'm sorry, you can probably hear my dog barking in the background.
Oh, no. I was gonna have mine come down and talk to him. We can welcome him on the show. That's a good thing, and thank goodness for dogs. But when it really comes down to it, that it is, we hold the absolute power. It's called he or she who holds the purse, holds the economy, holds the culture, holds the political ideology. That's really where it's at. And if we want to change, we want to create real change, it's, you just said it, it's with where and how you and I spend our money.
Absolutely. And, that's why, manufacturers are totally on top of this. That's why when you check out of the checkout counter, they're capturing all that information there. And every time you swipe a SKU number across the, or the cashier does, they capture all those SKUs that they're buying. It's not just for inventory purposes. Manufacturers are really crunching the data to see what you're buying, what you're choosing, what colors you like, and so on. And really, consumer clout in this country is so huge. If we all decided, it's why we have hybrid vehicles today. It's not because the auto companies necessarily wanted them. It's because consumers started demanding them. Auto companies are still up on the hill fighting tooth and nail the idea of raising fuel efficiency standards. But yet in the marketplace, every car they're talking about has some kind of hybrid engine or is fuel efficient or whatever. And it's because consumers are asking for them.
Absolutely. And I really believe when it really comes down to it, it's when you say consumers are asking, the consumer has the power. Now, through the media, we sway the consumer. There's no question about that. But when it really comes down to it, if people can just see through this madness of messages that we get constantly on a daily basis because somebody's trying to promote this idea, that concept, whatever it is, that it is the consumer. And the end result, The people really do have the power, and it's all in one very simple area. You just said it in the book. It's where you spend your money and how you spend your money. Based on how you and I spend a dollar is going to change the face of those people who are the recipients of those dollars. Based on how you and I spend the dollar, it's going to have a change of face on politics and everything else. So the real power we have, most people don't get that and they don't use that.
Well, you know, I think that people just don't realize it. People's lives are very, very busy. You know, most of the time you're just trying to get in and get out of the store because you've got so many things to do. You've got to take care of the house and you've got your family, you've got your dog, you've got the job. You know, they've just got a lot to do. And once you're used to buying a particular product, it's so much easier to keep buying the good old product instead of doing the research to find the new product that, in fact, might be better for you and might be better for the planet. And that is one of the reasons why I wrote Big Green Purse and why I have the BigGreenPurse.com website. You know, I hope that it helps people sort of cut through the confusion a little bit and think, you know, if they are looking for more eco-friendly clothes or a greener landscaping options or whatever it may be, that they can find it on a website like ours.
And by the way, I think people should go to the website. I really love what you had to say. Now, we're just about out of time. Very slowly, with your website, please.
www.biggreenpurse.com.
Okay, you talked me into it. I'll go out and get a green purse. They may look at me. Okay, by the way, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope people really get that book.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes along a wanna be. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. For you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us anytime during the show. Toll free, 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Belinda May with us is the nation's number one no-nonsense success strategist and consultant, helping time-challenged small business owners and entrepreneurs become more productive and the word is profitable. You got to love the word. She's also a speaker and the author of the motivating book, The Success Project, The Making of a Worthy Ideal. Belinda, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. How are you?
Thank you for having me. And how are you?
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
I'm a lot of high energy, so get ready.
I got it. I got it. I'm the hair on the back of my head standing up. I can deal with it. Now, by the way, we talk about profitability, the P word. There are so many people who are so time crunched today. They got so much more to do and less time to do it. And there usually is that something missing in the business that they seem like everybody else has got, but they don't really know where it is. What are we missing? What is it that when you walk into a business, what do you see that that business doesn't see?
Well, there's a lot of things that I can often see. And the first thing is I ask them, exactly what is it that you're hoping to accomplish? Because sometimes people are in business and, you know, they're looking to, they want to accomplish making money.
Sure.
But, you know, you're not in business. You're really not in the business to sell your product and service. You're really in the marketing business. And I think that's the piece that people forget sometimes. They think that, oh, if I build it, they'll come buy it. If I make these cupcakes, you know, I'll sell them. But you're in the marketing business first, and then based on that marketing is how you're going to be able to sell your products and services. So that's kind of what I see that a lot of people, especially small business owners, miss.
Let me tell you why I think people in business need people like yourself, and I think it's extremely important. You'll walk in and you'll look at it through a different set of eyes. And people need somebody that looks at what they have differently, because there's so many people in business, there's certain things they do not see. And it's not what they don't know that gets them in trouble. It's what they don't know they don't know. And just a little bit of a shift in the operational decision-making of a business can make all the difference in the world.
Exactly. It's almost like looking at a puzzle. It's like you have all the pieces to the puzzle. And, you know, sometimes you may get stumped putting it together, but a third eye comes along and says, oh, this piece goes right here.
Yeah.
And that is exactly, you know, what I do for my clients.
Now, by the way, when somebody comes to you, there's got to be an overarching problem that you constantly hear. And it's like with anybody who does anything, when they're a professional in a certain area, what's the one thing that you see that most people say, I don't know how to do it, or I don't know where it's at, or this is the area that I'm lost in? What do you see?
Well, you just said it. It's that question, I don't know how to do it. And I think that's where the problem comes in. And my answer to that is, do you even know what it is that you want to do?
Good point.
You know, I don't know how to start a business, or I don't know how, you know, to make it all work. And I think that the biggest thing that you have to understand is, if anything that you do, first starts with a decision. And once you decide exactly, and I mean exactly, specifically what it is that you want to have or want to do, then the door opens to help you find the roadmap or the path to get there.
Absolutely.
People all the time are saying, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how. Well, what is it that you want to do? I don't know. I just want to do something.
Yeah, and by the way, one of the best things that I have seen in all the years that I've been in and around businesses and so on and so forth, best thing that can happen to you is you fall down. Because when you fall down, if you've got the guts, you get back up again, and you're stronger than you were before, and you know how to look at something differently. Most of the time, businesses haven't fallen down. They're frightened to death that they won't make it in a certain area. Well, if you're heading in a direction and you're going to fail, fail. Because the fail is probably the best gift you can possibly have.
The fail, I mean, you know, that is another big word that I hear often is, you know, I just don't want to be a failure. You're not a failure. What you did failed. So you just learned one way that it's not going to work.
No, absolutely. So and one of the things that I've seen, and let me ask you if you've seen this in businesses also, is that in this down economy now, the quote-unquote recession, whatever that means, in the down, people are saying, you know, businesses are going out and they're trying to create new products and they're trying to get out there and be competitive with everybody, when it's not externally you've got to clean yourself up, it's internally. And I think doing the best with what you have is going to get somebody through whatever period this is until it changes, it turns around, or does whatever. It's taking care of the clients and the people that you got working for you right now. And that, I think, in and of itself is the lifeboat.
That is so true, Michael. I'm glad you brought that point up, because so many people are really out trying to make new dollars, trying to get new customers when you can make the same amount of money or even more money by just, you know, putting something in place for the existing customers that you already have. You already have these people that are coming to your business, you know, maybe once or twice, you know, a month. How can you get these people to come and spend dollars with you on a weekly basis? Or how can you get these people to refer other people to you who already know how great your product and service is? Instead of trying to go out and get someone who has never used you, never tested out any of your products, trying to convince them to take their dollars from somewhere else and put it with you. It first starts with just massaging those customers that you already have, putting in, you know, referral programs or putting in, you know, rewards programs for the existing customers. And I think a lot of people miss out on that because they're so busy trying to get, quote, new customers.
Sure. And by the way, and they have to define what a customer is. And I think, you know, you said it early on, you know, if you don't know, I'll say it in a different way, but if you don't know what your end result is, your end goal is, you're never going to get there. And it's actually a redefining. It's redefining of where you stand in the culture, where you stand with the kind of customer that you want. The other thing that I think a tremendous amount of people run into today, there's a new customer out there. That's that e-customer, that person, the, you know, the those that are growing up now that have had all this high technology behind them. You can get anything you want, anytime you want, with a press of a button on a computer. So it's learning how to speak that language to that e-customer out there, that e-buyer.
Absolutely. And you can, you know, and so often with things like all the different free webinars, free teleconference, Ustream, all of these other, you know, products that are here on the Internet, you can actually take a local business and make it a global business by just using these, you know, the free tools that are available to you. But, you know, some people are saying, you know, I don't have time. I don't have time for that. It just seems so complex. What's complex about turning on your webcam and logging onto a website and doing a live Ustream demonstration and charging for it?
Wait. There's a way to do that. You ready for this answer? This is it. This is it. If you really are afraid to death of technology, if you don't want to sit down and take the time to do it, you ask a 12-year-old.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Give it to somebody. But there's a point in that. You can't know everything. So you bring the people around you, the people that you hire, to augment your skills. That's really the way to do it. The people that you hire should know more than you do.
Absolutely. And then one thing that I've been able, you know, to do in this economy that kind of helped me to expand my brand, and people may say, well, I don't have the money to hire someone. You know, I've had a full staff of free labor, college interns, and I treat them a little bit differently. I actually pick interns who are majoring, of course, in exactly what it is that I need. And then have them be that point person for that, because not only do they have the tenacity and their, you know, the wherewithal to actually get the job done, they want to do it. And all of the interns are virtual, so the days of, you know, having the labor come to you and you know, have them in your office is over. You have so many other resources that you can actually get whatever it is you want done, done for very minimal cost.
No, it's amazing. You know, the old days, you went to work at 9 o'clock and you broke for lunch at noon to whatever. And then you came back and you finished the day up at 4 or 5 o'clock and you had to sit behind a desk and do whatever. You know, in today's world, you can be sitting out on the beach, getting a tan, doing whatever you want, enjoying yourself. And you got your BlackBerry and you're doing all your work.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is how businesses are run and how people are making money. So, and you know, in this economy, if you're sitting around waiting for the government to save you, I'm sorry, you're going down. There's so many useful tools out here that's available just a click away that you can start using right now in this economy in order to start creating a supplemental income for yourself. It's not a full-time income.
No, absolutely. I was going to say, I completely and I totally agree. You can be doing anything that you want to do. You can go back to your pool and sit down and enjoy lunch with somebody that you'd love to have lunch with. And at the same time, you as small as something that you can put in your hand, you can be dealing with millions of dollars of products and services and marketing and sales.
Absolutely. And trying to convince people of that you know, some kinds sometimes can be, you know, a daunting task. So that's why I don't really convince. I just, here's the information, and if you want to take control of your own financial future, here it is.
Yeah.
You know, if you're waiting for the new president to be elected and to create a job for you, then, you know, that's your choice as well. But I'm very pro-entrepreneurship, I think, is definitely the way to go.
Oh, absolutely. And entrepreneurship today, there are people who are frightened to death of that word because, you know, if you define an entrepreneur, it's somebody who's got money, invests in this and does this, and it's a Donald Trump. That's not so. The entrepreneur today is that man or woman who's sitting behind, they're sitting at their kitchen table with their computer, and they're in business for themselves. That's an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you can start, you know, for those that may say, well, you know, it's 10% unemployment. You know, and I just don't think that I can. I mean, 10% unemployment, yeah, that's bad. But think about it. 90% of the people are working. That's kind of how I flip it in order to have a positive mindset on it. Yes, there's a lot of people out of work, but there's a lot of people that are working. And you can use this time to draw your unemployment and then turn that $300 a week or whatever it is into a business.
Yeah.
You've got to be creative and innovative if you're going to, you know, survive this, quote, recession.
In today's world, absolutely. One more thing, and we're going to start to run out of time. And you address it, but I'm going to say it in a different way. Most people think they need a support system. And a support system is a wonderful thing to do. And if you've got the idea to go ahead and do it, and if somebody in your family does not have that kind of strength that you have, don't listen to them. Go do what you're doing.
I totally agree, Michael. And one thing that I've actually done is, you know, you start your own support system. There's a website, meetup.com, that you can find people who are doing everything under the sun, who are like-minded like you, that you can connect with those individuals, or you can create your own. So instead of you sitting around saying people don't support what I'm doing, go out and create your own support network and just get going.
No question about it. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Please, website we can find you at, get the book, and find out more and follow you.
Yes, the name of the book is The Success Project, The Making of a Worthy Ideal. And basically, it's about redefining what success means for you. And the best definition of success that I've ever heard was from Earl Nightingale, which said, you know, success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. So it's forever moving, and never underestimate the baby steps. And you can find out more about me and my book at belindamays.com. That's BELINDAMAYS.com. And you can also purchase The Success Project right on my website, and it's available on Amazon as well in Kindle format too.
Belinda, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And you were exciting to have here.
Thank you so much for having me, and I wish you all the best.
You too. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Of her charms because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471 if you want to join in. Gary Stokes with us. He's the author of Poise, A Warrior's Guide. He's a researcher, he's a speaker, and he's a transformational coach. He advises leaders in government, business, and organizations. And again, his latest acclaimed book is Poise, A Warrior's Guide. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm pleased to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I want to do something from your press release, your press kit, because it really says it all, and we have problems here. And then I'm going to ask for the definition of a warrior. Accusations, name-calling, complaining, whining, and the whole nation suffers, and we become a culture of victims when our leaders lose their cool while campaigning. Where have we turned, Gary, to this finger-pointing? I've never seen it as bad. I remember when Democrats and Republicans could battle and fight, and then they'd go out and have lunch together, pat each other in the back, they'd be best of friends, and they'd go back and battle. We've gotten into a position now that you even have both parties doing the same thing to each other. You're watching what's going on with the GOP convention. You're seeing that each one is telling you how terrible the other one is. And the problem with that, with the finger pointing and the rest of it that we're talking about here, is that when one is chosen, they're going to go into that presidential race with all of that garbage that was brought to them by somebody else in the same party.
Yep. It's a discouraging situation, isn't it?
Yeah.
But strangely enough, Michael, I think there might be a couple of things that we haven't thought about all this. Of course, my subject is poise, which is the most vibrant and joyful state that we can achieve. And the great enemy of poise is self-pity. And I believe that one thing that maybe we haven't talked about is that politicians themselves, especially the people at the top that you're talking about, are pretty poised people. I mean, they're not people that blow their cool easily. If they do, they're not in the race very long.
Sure.
So they're under immense scrutiny. They're under immense stress and pressure. So these people are pretty poised. But I think some of them understand the tremendous degree to which, at our state of evolution, the human species feels sorry for itself, tapping into that self-pity. And in my view, that's what's going on. These tremendous victim stories that the politicians are cooking up appeal to the voters' self-pity, and the politicians say, yes, things are terrible for you. We know how bad things are for you, and I can't talk about that enough. And if you elect me, I'll take all your pain away.
Yeah. And I think, Gary, that's the problem. We've gotten to a position where, excuse me, that life in this country is almost like a soap opera. Everybody is tied into the drama and the problem that somebody else is having. And I really believe we're getting to a point now where we're not believing those people that are in the positions of power when they promise. They promise because this is what they want somebody to hear. Both sides of the aisle. I mean, it doesn't really matter where they are. It's almost a political culture today, and there's a tremendous amount of people falling into it. We've gotten to a point where if somebody is on unemployment, they're making $300-$400 more a month than the average person is working out there. So why do it? And we've heard about the 2-3% of the people that are unemployed. Well, it's actually larger than that, because when they go off unemployment, if some of them, it's almost like going to war and coming back with depression, etc. They go over on disability. So what we're seeing is the government's still putting out money, but for people on disability, because they can't emotionally function, go out and get a job, and we're seeing a X amount of unemployment rate. So you're right. We've lost the poise.
But of course, we'll always have differences of opinion, won't we, about
sure.
policy, we'll always be cooking up, I hope, and you hope, I know too, better and better explanations for our democratic process. And the explanations that we have at any moment are never adequate, you know, so we never get the final explanation, so we're always working toward a better model. All of that seems completely legitimate. What troubles me is how easy it is to prick the anger, irritability, and impatience of the electorate. You know, none of this angry and ugly appeal by political candidates would work if a large portion of the public didn't feel sorry for themselves and if they weren't angry. You know, this stuff doesn't work with a person who isn't angry.
Sure. Now
we get to the point, well, is anger a legitimate emotion? And in my view, no, it isn't. When we are angry, we feel sorry for ourselves, we distort things, we lose our perspective, we can't enjoy life, and worst of all, we lose access to our love. So we can't really find any anger we can't find any virtue in anger. So if we have still, at the development level of our species, a great deal of anger and victimhood, then leaders will always appeal to that and will always tell us that they'll rescue us from this emotional suffering.
Yeah. Now, by the way, well, I want to talk about what a warrior is. My definition of a warrior would be somebody who takes up the sword to protect and defend, you know, his or her tribe, quote unquote. And what I'm seeing now, the warriors are people who are fighting within themselves and dividing. That's one of the biggest problems that we have with everything that you're talking about. It divides the country in such a way. It's not just your idea and my idea. Let's come to the table, values neutral, and work something out so everybody's happy. It doesn't work that way anymore. I have never seen such a division in this country, and I've been around here for a lot of years now, that it's you know, you've got black against white. You've got Latino against black. You've got women against women. You've got men against women. And I mean, this list goes on. There isn't a group that we have in this country that for some reason doesn't hate the other group. And that was set up. That was set up to be able to be in control.
Well, about warriors and how I'm defining that word, Michael, for me, a warrior is an impeccable man or woman who understands what a brief time we have left on this earth in our own lifetime. In other words, a warrior is someone who is seeking enough personal power and understanding and wisdom and courage to live every life, to live every moment as fully as possible. So for me, a warrior is the most admirable of persons and the epitome of poise, a person who's able to be in the moment and to say yes to life no matter what challenges life presents.
Yeah, and by the way, we're going to have the same definition. Let me tie that back. You know, the warrior, somebody, you know, takes up the cause, the sword, the whatever, to protect and defend, you know, his or her tribe, their family, their country, their whatever. And it is living in the moment. It is living an ideology. It is living a philosophy that there is, you know, equality of opportunity, and we're living in the best place you could possibly live in. So I really believe we're saying the same thing. It just tied into two different sets of saying it. We went from honoring who we are and proud of who we are to every time we turn around, you're going to make an excuse for being alive. And if you have to make an excuse for being alive, that creates anger. The anger ends up getting turned on yourself, and no longer are you a warrior, but you're a slave. You're a slave to whatever the culture dictates or the policies of the time dictates at that moment.
Yes, and maybe, Michael, we forget. I'm not convinced that there were ever any better periods in human history than this moment. And yeah. Imagine, for instance, if we looked at the division of the country, imagine what it must have been like in the United States during the period of slavery and during the period of the Civil War. You know, this country, half of our country wanted to break away from the other half. We don't have any kind of, we don't quite have it that bad, you know. So in my view, we have evolved, however slowly, And yes, though, we still have, as a human species, and it's not just in the United States, it's everywhere on the earth, we still have in our species, we're a fragile species, and we can feel sorry for ourselves. And when we do, unfortunately, then we're acting out of anger and impatience and our irritation, and we're making decisions for our life. We're engaging with life out of that emotional state, and then we make up these bad explanations. Ah, well, it's not my feelings that are responsible here for how miserable I am. It's you. You know, you Republicans or you Democrats or you women or you men or you blacks or you whites or you poor people or you rich people, we can always find a target for our misery to lay out who's responsible for me feeling so bad.
No, absolutely. No question about it. And this, Gary, is learned. It's learned. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you take the philosophy that you were talking about right now, put it into the homes for when those kids, right before they start school, and as they go through school, classes in that. It's self-esteem, it's confidence, and realizing there's consequence for your action, and take the responsibility for your emotions. If you walk up to me in the street and you smack me in the nose, I can't stop you from doing it, but what I can do is control how I feel about it. And that's really where it is. You deal with what you got at the moment that you got it. But that's a philosophy that seems to be getting lost now.
I love your idea, Michael. Why don't we write a new book together, and it will be what we wish that our parents had taught us.
And
actually, I've been thinking about that lately, and of course, my parents didn't teach me what I'm about to say. It took me a long time to learn it. But what if our parents had said from our first cognitive moment, look, Gary and Michael, here's how it is. Life is a marvelous thing, and you may not ever say no to it. You must say yes to it, because even though it's going to be challenging at times, it's a short period you're going to get to live. And so here in our household, we say yes to life, and we are full of love. We're full of creativity. We are we're very grateful for everything that's happening. We have access to our love, and we don't ever complain. Nope, that's crazy to complain. So our response to life is love, and we say yes to life no matter what it presents.
Okay, I've almost got the title.
What would our lives have been like if our parents had told us that?
Oh, I've almost got the title here. This is our killer title. All right. Well, okay. Here it is. Needing a little more on the tagline. The name of the book is "What Mom and Dad Didn't Say," and the tagline is "Life is what you make it." No good.
Yes. No, I like it. I was just thinking. I wrote it down. And I thought, well, what mom and dad didn't know.
Didn't say. You know, no.
You know, my parents didn't know what I just said, Michael. They believed that the best you could do in life was that life was good some of the time, and then some of the time it was really bad. And then there were things in between. So if we told a kid, well, no, that's a bad paradigm. It's not even true. Life is always what it is, and so if you want to argue with it, you're going to suffer. So it's stupid to argue with life. Instead, engage with it creatively, engage with it with your greatest gratitude, engage with it with your love, and your life will be a dream.
Yeah, they got it. And really, yeah, when it comes down to it, I was my mom and dad. My dad was born in 1889, and my mom was born in 1910, and they came from a completely different mindset. And if you really think about it, you know, with my mom, she saw everything. She saw the beginning of, you know, automobiles. She saw the first flights. You know, the first person to walk on the moon. I mean, it went on and on. We lost her in 1993. They came from a different mindset. They also came from a place of being responsible, and there were consequences. You stepped out of line at home. Can you imagine walking into your house and using a four-letter expletive to your mom or dad? I'll bet that sends chills down your spine right now.
Well, that wouldn't have been a wise thing to do at my house. That's true.
Okay, mine either. See, and I think that's what we're really dealing with here, with what you're talking about. It's taking responsibility, realizing that you're not a victim. The person that's made you a victim, if you are, is that person that you're looking at in the mirror. And that's where it stops, right then and there. And if we had more of that personal responsibility and it was taught at home and in the schools, life would be completely different.
Well, one thing that I've concluded, Michael, about that in my work on this subject and in my observations and in my coaching with leaders in the United States is that it's a very small percentage of the human species that has come to an understanding about what we're talking about.
Sure.
Very few people, in my experience, and all of my friends like are very well-educated people and brilliantly educated, probably, but this is not a subject that they've dug into. And so their lives are those lives that have good things and bad things. But for the warrior, in my view, there's just the good things. Now, that isn't Pollyannish. I don't mean to sound naive here. It's not as if the poised warrior doesn't have challenges. It could be that we would have immense challenges, personal challenges, immense challenges. It's just that we wouldn't feel sorry for ourselves in the face of those challenges. We would just say, yes, now this, and we would engage with whatever was happening with great poise, with great creativity, gratitude, and love.
Now, by the way, we're starting.
That seems to me this is a choice. This really is a possibility, and there are people that live in this state of consciousness.
No, by the way, absolutely right. We're starting to run out of time now, and I want to leave it with this. You got your pencil still handy?
I do.
Okay, what Mom and Dad didn't say, life is what you make it, not what somebody else caused it to be.
Yes, yeah, I like
there's,
it.
There's your next book.
One of us should write this book, Michael.
I got it. But it's true. Just that in and of itself really says that's almost 90% of everybody's story here in the United States and actually in the world when you think about it. It's what you make it, not what somebody else caused it to be. We look for love and we look for acceptance so strong, and it means so much to everybody that you're under the veil of somebody else's opinion. You want to be like what they say just so you get accepted. How about look in the mirror, accept yourself, and that's your first step.
The great teacher Krishnamurti, I'll end on this note, Michael. The great teacher Krishnamurti said that the secret of his wisdom was, I don't mind what's happening.
Yeah. Okay, and there was somebody in New York that once said, I remember very well, he said, if I knew I could have gone, I would have went. Okay, and with that, we're about out of time. Gary, thank you. Oh, by the way, your website, please.
It's www.warriorpublishers.com.
Wonderful.
And the title of my title of my book, which is now available on Amazon, is Poise, A Warrior's Guide.
Dynamite. Hey, Gary Stokes, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been enjoyable, Michael. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Timothy Vick with us, and he is the Senior Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager and the Senior Vice President, Sanibel Captiva Investment Advisors. And we're going to talk about stock market. We're going to talk about the way to take a look at things. He's the author of How to Pick Stocks Like Warren Buffett and Profiting from the bargain hunting strategies of the world's greatest value investor. Tim, hi, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. Good evening to all your listeners, too.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we really come down to it, people are so confused when it comes to picking stocks, investing today. And unless they're professionals, they're frightened to death of doing anything because you've got all the Madoffs that were out there and what's going on in the world and what's going on politically. It's a very frightening time for people.
It is. In fact, we hear from clients and investors all the time that they can't make sense of this market anymore. They know it has been taken over almost completely, not completely. But almost completely by computers and algorithms and hedge funds and short-term traders, and they're trying to figure out how to make sense of it. And not only that, but you know, after 10 years of a market that's been a giant roller coaster to them, they look at their 401ks and their IRA accounts and see that they're not much higher than they were in 2000, 2001, and a lot of them, frankly, are getting very frustrated with the system, you know, system in quote marks. They think that there is something in this game that just doesn't work isn't working for them anymore like it used to in the 80s and 90s. And we're seeing a lot of frustration at the individual shareholder level. And, in times like this, I think you want to go back to basics. You want to go back to the old master investors and study what they're doing. And to me, someone like Warren Buffett, who is not only just a financial idol to all of us, but, just a mentor, is someone that I think you really want to glom onto in a time like this.
Sure, that's where I was going to go with this, because when it really comes down to it, you need somebody to, a mentor is a wonderful word, but you need somebody to model after. You need somebody who's been there, who's done that, has been consistent in what they've done, and even under the toughest times, seems to have been able to see that light at the end of the tunnel. Now, Buffett in and of himself, when you would describe Buffett from your experience, what do we see when we look at Warren Buffett?
Well, I always wonder when I go to his annual meetings in Omaha, which now draw about 40,000 people a year, but what draws people to him and to this company that he created like a patchwork quilt back in 1965? And, of course, success is the first thing. Here's a guy that started right out of college with $100 that he invested in his own partnership and turned it into $30 billion. And people are intrigued how someone can do this, in this day and age, or at least in the middle part of the 20th century, how they can accumulate that much wealth starting with almost nothing in a 50-year time period. So there's always that kind of natural intrigue to figure out, can I do what he did over that time? But when you go to these annual meetings and listen to them or hear the interviews, you hear this kind of homespun, down-to-earth advice that everybody can identify with. There is a Midwest kind of humility to Mr. Buffett. He's very fallible. He shows and talks about his inability to predict markets and, makes no bones of the fact that he's not a timer or anything. He just is an old-fashioned type who looks at annual reports, reads them cover to cover, and still finds ways to extract value, beating all the computers and the hedge funds and all the algorithms that have been built over the last 10 years. And this is just the amazing thing about him. He's also the last of a breed. We talk about this greatest generation of investors, the John Templetons of the world, the Peter Lynches, the Julian Robertsons, Shelby Davis, Ben Graham, Bill Ruane, the old gentlemen who just using down-to-earth methods of analyzing companies, were able to just build great fortunes. And he's one of the last ones that's still around. And no, I think as he gets on in years, people just want to know, you know, naturally, what is it? What can I follow in him that, you know, can give me more success than I've had the last 10 years?
You know, one of the ways to find that out is obviously every year is, you know, he does an annual letter. He does it to the shareholders. But in each one of the letters, there's got to be a takeaway, an essence of something that everybody can glom onto. This last time, what was the takeaway? And the other side of that is his thinking changing a bit because of the dynamic of the economy today in relation to the world?
Well, one of the amazing things about his letters, and he's been putting them on the website and writing them since 1977, and I have his writings going back to the 1950s, is that he really doesn't change. And you can read his letters from 2011 and compare them to the letters he wrote in 1957 when he had a limited partnership, and it's like you're reading a letter from a gentleman who wrote the letters 2 weeks apart. Nothing has really changed the way he looks at companies, the way he looks at economies, the way he looks at currencies or interest rates. He really set his pattern of investing in place 4 and 5 decades ago. So we're always going to get that kind of consistency out of him. He may be looking at different types of investments, but the way he's going to look at them, the grounding he gave himself 4 and 5 decades ago really hasn't changed. And that's, you know, just a marvel, and just that constancy of purpose that drives him is what I think has been, you know, behind a lot of his results. Now, we, as kind of Berkshire Hathaway, you know, watchers, look at his letters every year and his annual meetings to try to detect if there's any subtle shifts in the way he looks at the macro world. And, you know, one of the things that's really been on our minds the last couple of years has been this issue of succession. He's 81 years old now. He's been running the company since 1965. Clearly, his best days are behind him in terms of performance. We know he's not going to be there forever, and we need to hear from him, you know, that he has selected the leaders that are going to follow him. And this year in his annual letter, he's given us that kind of confidence. He's told us about what the plans are for succession. And I think that's put a lot of shareholders at ease.
Yeah, Tim, you're in the same business, and he's got to be a tremendous role model for you. What is it that you see about Buffett in yourself? What is it that you modeled after him? And if I were to look deep down into Buffett and I look deep down into you, where would I find the commonality? What is it that you've learned from him?
I'm a Midwesterner too, and I grew up not too far from Interstate 80, and Omaha is right on Interstate 80 as well. And, you know, we Midwesterners have we're a little skeptical of things that are exotic. We're skeptical of anything that's on Wall Street. You combine that with just a good grounding in finance, in financial theory, and just use good old Midwestern common sense, I think you can ferret out values in the market. I hope better than what other people can ferret out. At least you can break away through the clouds and cut away the noise and just see where real values are. I'm still a believer that you can find good investments without a computer just by reading annual reports and just understanding how businesses work, really taking them apart, understanding how to value them, and just patiently waiting until the market throws what Buffett calls a fat pitch your direction. If you're looking at a, you know, great company, let's call it a Microsoft or a company like that, that you might have it on your radar screen that I'll buy it when it gets down to $25 a share, and if it takes 2 years to get to $25, you don't touch it until it gets to that price. And that sort of patience, you know, combined with just a knowledge of how markets work, I think is going to come out and it's going to yield some good results for you.
Now, by the way, is he a little bit of a psychic? Is he intuitive? Because he seems to forecast whatever was going on in the economy, he forecasted before. Is this based on his knowledge of the market and the cyclical ideology of the market? Because it goes up and down, and it goes up and down, and if it goes down, you know it's going to come back up again. What was that secret of his that allowed him to be able to forecast?
Well, I think a lot of folks in this industry pretend to be good forecasters and can read tea leaves or claim to read tea leaves. But with Buffett, I think it's always been a matter of what we call pattern recognition. You know, the fact that over 5 and 6 decades, he has studied so many thousands of companies and looked at their financials in depth. He's met with thousands of business leaders and politicians and political leaders from around the world. He can judge a good investment very quickly. I'm amazed when you hear about when he will purchase a company that he'll make an offer to the business owner and, you know, price will be agreed upon within a day and then the deal will be consummated. Mr. Buffett just needs to look at a few sheets of financial statements on that company. He has to look that owner directly in the eye and just sense that this is a trusting individual who knows how to build value in his business, and he goes from there. It doesn't take lawyers and accountants. It doesn't doesn't take any prognostications about where the stock market's going, or you don't really have to care where the Dow Jones Industrial Average is going to be in a couple months. If you see a good investment, you just spring on it. And you know, to this point, he's also been very good through this pattern recognition of just seeing problems in the market before they occurred. Now, I've been reading his annual reports for a long period of time, and it's very uncanny just how he's been able to identify things like lax lending standards and derivatives problems and restructuring charges and all the accounting for options problems that internet problems companies got themselves into 10 or 11 years ago. Every leading problem that has caused a major issue on Wall Street, he wrote about it 2 or 3 years before it occurred. And, not because he was prescient or, could time those events occurring, but just through his ability to read hundreds and hundreds of annual reports, he saw trends that were developing. And those trends would tell him to back off and stay away from that particular sector or those types of investments. And it's proven right. He was always early. He was always the type of person to leave a party at 10 p.m. sober while everyone was still partying until midnight, but he was not the type of who was still at the party at midnight and turned into a pumpkin or a mouse.
Now, by the way, politically and recently with this millionaire's tax, his name was all over the place with this, and he wasn't getting a great response for it. What do you think he decided that there should be the millionaire's tax?
Well, I have mixed opinions on that. For one, I believe that he has a not-so-subtle message out there that for us in this business, it's been a little too easy to make a fortune trading financial products the last 20 years. And
sure.
The way to do that has been to just borrow other people's money and buy assets that appreciated, and lower interest rates help you do that. And I think he probably feels, and I can't speak for him directly, but I think he feels that those in the industry who built these fabulous fortunes through this kind of leverage, they should feel obligated to, let's say, tip the dealer who dealt him those good hands. I think he's coming from that kind of direction, that anyone who's built fabulous fortunes in the 80s and 90s and even the last 5 years where they were hedge fund managers or such, were gifted this wonderful environment of lower taxes, of lower and lower interest rates, of just booming asset prices, and they owe it back to society to just kind of spread their wealth around. Now, this has generated some mixed opinions. I know a lot of Berkshire Hathaway shareholders who were just flabbergasted that he came out with that policy, and some have actually sold the shares and don't want any part of Berkshire Hathaway anymore. But I tend to defer to his wisdom and judgment. I know I have to advocate on behalf of my clients who don't want to see higher taxes themselves, but
sure.
In the back of my mind, seeing what I've seen happen in this industry the last 20 years, I've got to defer to his judgment. I see where he's coming from. There are some folks here who made extreme amounts of money in this industry only because gifts were handed to them in terms of the perfect storm of investing climate.
Sure, and there are fewer of those than there are the quote-unquote millionaire entrepreneurs, heads of companies, the Steve Jobs, and the rest of them. And one of the things that I see with this is where I would disagree with him across the board. If somebody has got the ability to be creative enough to be in that position, pay him for it. The other side of that is if somebody's creative enough to do that, it also creates the incentive to go out and market new products, new services, new whatever, which in and of itself is job creation. You put enough roadblocks in front of somebody making money, they're not going to do it. If they don't do it, then the population in and of itself suffers. But that's just one opinion, though.
Well, it's real hard to explain to the rest of the world why salaries have escalated, for a certain level of folks in the United States as they have the last 20 years. Some of it is just the fact that people can scale their income like they never could before, particularly in the financial services industry. Most of these companies that we talk about where they pay their partners tremendous amounts of money, or the hedge, you hear about hedge funds who,
yeah, sure,
whose leading partners might make $1 billion in a single year. They have the ability to just lever assets like as they never could before. And those avenues, were never available. And they took full advantage of it. And I think Mr. Buffett is, he's witnesses for, growing and growing, just like salaries for athletes and entertainers have escalated, to the point where, a $10 million salary is not considered that expensive anymore for that industry. But he's witnesses. To the point there, I think he's finally feel he's got to, talk it up and speak out against it. This has been something that's probably been gnawing at him for 20 or 30 years, but as he's getting further into his career and maybe toward the last few years of running Berkshire Hathaway, he feels he finally wants that form and just wants to kind of explain himself.
No, and as a matter of fact, the leveraging in and of itself, which is that which caused the housing industry problem. The packages that were leveraged and the packages that were created by more packages. I mean, the list goes on and on. Okay, we're about out of time. Tim, is there a website that we can find you at, buy the book, and find out more information?
Yes, the name of the book is How to Pick Stocks Like Warren Buffett, and it was published by McGraw-Hill. And our website for Sanibel Captiva Investment Advisors is www.scia/capital.com. That's SCIA/capital.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Tim Vick, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Always a pleasure, and have a good evening, Michael.
And by the way, I can disagree with Buffett, but I wished I would have done what he did. Okay, thanks. Good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Join us toll free, 888-429-5471. Linda Nigma with us. She's the author of Fight to Live, the story of her fight for survival after her diagnosis of kidney failure. And she was dying of kidney failure, spending a large part of her week at dialysis when she learned her sister-in-law was a perfect match as a kidney donor. And she knows how lucky she was, because many people die while waiting for a suitable donor. And let's say, Linda, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Oh, I am good. And thank you so much for being here. Did I pronounce your last name right?
Yes, you did.
Oh, good. I got 10 points for the side of the desk. By the way, It must be very scary to be under dialysis and to find a donor. Did you even know it was possible to get a donor to replace the organ?
Yes, I did. I was very fortunate. When I was first diagnosed, my sister-in-law offered to give me one of her kidneys, but we had this obstacle called I had too much weight. I was weighing, and when I was diagnosed, I weighed 446 pounds.
Yeah.
In order to have in order to get through dialysis onto the kidney, I had to lose 220 pounds. So I went through 3.5 years of dialysis, and about the first of the 3 years, my sister-in-law was then told that she should start being tested.
Yeah.
And the testing took about 6 months. And when she found out and called me and said, well, we're a match. And it was just unbelievable, because I had always thought, like most people, that you have to be a blood relative in order to get a kidney from someone. And with all the advances they have made nowadays, you don't have to do that. It just has to be someone who's willing to give you one.
Yeah, Linda, let me ask you this. The weight, the 446 pounds, was that a byproduct of the kidney problems? Was that a byproduct of your health, or did the weight cause the problem? It's kind of which was there first, the chicken or the egg. Which was it that caused the problem?
They never actually were able to determine why I had kidney failure.
Okay.
The thing was, I had always been heavy all of my life. It just kind of was a family trait.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really was one who ate a lot. And then all of a sudden, in like the late part of 2006, I started gaining a lot of weight. And there was no explanation for it. And come the first part of the year, it was very difficult for me to even walk across the room without being out of breath. Partway through that, I had so much fluid in my system that even my legs were seeping fluid out of them, if you could imagine how scary that was.
Sure.
And I had been going to the doctor off and on, I would say maybe once, sometimes twice a week, and never once did he actually check my kidneys. And I ended up in Las Vegas. I was there for work and ended up in emergency in a hospital in Las Vegas that actually saved my life.
Wow.
They determined that I had kidney failure. And when I was admitted to the hospital, I weighed 446 pounds. I had no clue what I weighed because, as you can imagine, there's not many scales that can weigh when you're that heavy.
Yeah.
And the doctor there, my husband, asked him, what's the prognosis? And he says, well, she's going to have stroke after stroke, and then she's going to die. And my thoughts were, wow, somebody's finally figured out what's wrong with me. I'm not going to die. We can work on it now.
No, but it's a good mindset. It's really, truly a good mindset. Linda, there's so many people out there, when the doctor says you're going to die, well, they take the suggestion, and guess what? They die. Now, let me ask you a question. The fight to live. What's the impetus of the book? What's the core message here? I'm listening to you. What do you want me to know?
The core message for my book is you need to really fight for yourself. You need to be your own advocate. Because, like most people would think this book is about weight loss, it's not. It's about survival. It's about how you go 3 times a week, 3 hours a day, all year long. You have, with me, it was like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I was at dialysis at 5:30 in the morning, there for 3 hours. Well, during that time, a lot of people don't realize about dialysis that you sit there with your arms straight out, and the machine actually acts as a kidney for you, an artificial kidney. It filters all of your blood. It takes it out, brings it back through the machine. Your entire blood system is totally pulled out and cleaned during that three-hour period. And many things can happen. It's very difficult for your heart. And you have to have the right attitude. People would ask me, how can you go to dialysis? I says, well, it's either that or you die. And that is the message. And it's like you need to be out there fighting for yourself. It's no longer, if a doctor tells me something, do I say, oh, okay, that must be right. I question things a lot more than I ever did before. And the important thing is there's, in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, it's an 8.5-year wait for a kidney. Someone will sit on there, and a lot of times people don't even live that long. because it's on your heart. They die from other diseases, or they're too old, or they've died when the kidney becomes available for them. So one of the things I want people to understand from my book as well is how important it is for there to be living donors. I was very fortunate.
Yep.
I had my sister-in-law and I had someone else. But some people, they say that 80% of the population knows someone, has a family member or a friend that's on dialysis. In the United States, there's 400,000 people that are on dialysis today.
Well, let me ask you this. For the average person who does not know, let's say that you and I matched up. What would my normal fears be? What would cause me not to donate the organ?
The biggest fear for people is, well, what happens if something happens to my kidney? And it's a leap of faith, basically, that people do. But a lot of times, people don't even realize. Like, someone might not even know that they can donate a kidney to you. For instance, like we were talking, you think you have to be a blood relative. And I'm trying to bring awareness to people that I'm, as a kid, as someone who needed a kidney, I would have never thought to go up to someone and say, hey, by the way, I need a kidney. Would you mind donating one? You know, it's people that come to you.
Yeah. Now, by the way,
say that. Yeah.
One of the things I think it's critically important for people to know about this, and I didn't even realize this until you and I are talking this moment, there are organ donation networks out there where people can get all kinds of information.
That is correct. And one of the most important ones that's out there, the one that's the most knowledgeable, is called the United Network for Organ Sharing. And that website is www.unos.org. That website will tell you all about transplants, whether it's a kidney transplant, lungs, you know, pancreas, whatever type of transplant you're looking for. It gives you the information about it. There is also a new part of an organization that is called, it's called the kidney, it's the Living Kidney Donors. It's a new one that's out there. And what it does is it basically links people together. For instance, say you wanted to donate a kidney to me, and I couldn't, we're not a match, but you're still willing to donate your kidney to someone. There's a new thing going on right now where people, it's called Chains. They just completed one. There was an article a while back from the New York Times that went through this work. There were actually 60 people involved, 30 people who donated kidneys to 30 other people that they may not have even known. Just, you're this person, doesn't connect with this one, but he connects with another or another one in this group. And this is brand new that's out there. And it's truly amazing what they can do nowadays. The one I was talking about is called the National Kidney Registry, and it is facilitating living donor transplants. And that website is www.kidneyregistry.org.
Okay,
and
now let's say I was in that situation. I needed a kidney. How do I find one? Do I buy the kidney? Do I get it donated? How do I find that? Does it go through the doctors? What occurs when someone finds that they're going to have to be on dialysis and they need a kidney? What's the step to finding the kidney?
There's only a few ways you can go. You can get on the transplant list, and that's in every area has a kidney transplant list. And that first, the first one I gave you, the United Network for Organ Sharing, they're there for every kind of one. You can go there and find out information about being on the transplant list. Those donations come from people once they've died. Everywhere in the country has different times that it takes to get a kidney. And for instance, at one point when I was looking in Idaho, it was 18 months And so it's different in different parts of the country. But you cannot buy one. That is against the law. And I think people are, that's some things that have been coming up that people have been asking about is, can I buy a kidney somewhere? Or a, you know, you just can't. You just can't. It's against the law.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I can see that because let's face it, if I've got a lot of money, I can go out and buy kidneys and start charging. I can become a billionaire based on somebody else who's going to die or not to die.
That's very true.
Yeah,
and
that's
that would
good.
Happen very quickly.
Yeah.
Very quickly. Your the dialysis centers will set you up with the hospitals that actually do the transplants because not all hospitals do, as I'm sure you are aware of that. In my area, there's three, two in San Francisco and one in Palo Alto. But they're all throughout the country. There's different hospitals that do it. And all the dialysis centers know which hospitals.
Okay, so in essence, there's a network.
Right. There is a network out there. And there's all kind of transplants that happen. Now, you don't have to live in the area to have a transplant done there. The hospital that I went through was Stanford. And if anybody would be interested in donating a kidney or getting information about kidney transplant, I can give you a telephone number if you'd like for Stanford.
Sure.
And their number is 650-736-0795. Or their website is stanfordhospital.org/kidney transplant. And there's just lots and lots of information on these websites that can help people out. And for people who might be on dialysis, there are many support groups out there if people would just go to the websites on there and just pull up dialysis support groups, and they'll pop up for them.
Wonderful. We're starting to run out of time now. Please, one more time, with your website.
My website is afighttolive.com.
www.afighttolive.com. Now, can we get the book there and get other information?
Yes, the book is there. There's some information on there. There's links right to Stanford on there. There's links to two websites where the books can be purchased. And that people can go there. It's available in the electronic ways on Amazon and on Barnes and Noble, and there's also the soft pack and the hardback.
By the way, Linda, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. And people will be able to listen to this show. We'll have it. What's the word I want to use? Radio Susie podcast. We'll have it. And if anybody missed it, they can share it. Okay, Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you. Have a wonderful
evening.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. Say that one more time.
And I am Radio Susan.
Somebody hit the wrong button. And that, my friends, is I did.
A wrap.
Good night.
These dusty walls. If I had this to do again. And the evening were new again. I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls. Oh!
dusting